Mountain Head. January 24th features local indie rock outfit Cassador. On January 26th, Bedouin Soundclash takes the stage. February 7th sees Busty and the Bass come to town. And on February 19th, it's a special Wednesday night rock show with headliners Dear Rouge. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the armies of human workers who fool you into thinking that AI is magic.
For the AI behind autonomous vehicles to understand the difference between cars, traffic lights, and pedestrians, every frame of the archives used to train these systems has to have the appropriate objects. People, signposts, cats, trees, other cars, labeled with near-perfect accuracy.
For 1 hour of annotated footage, it takes 800 human hours to annotate that footage correctly.
Wait for that. Everybody's talking about Elon Musk's weird new job in the Trump administration. But did you know that Justin Trudeau created something called the Artificial Intelligence Secretariat? Just this past summer, Trudeau appointed Canada's first Deputy Secretary for AI, a guy named Mark Shawn. Now, most people who follow AI would agree that government needs to be involved with it, primarily with respect to regulating it. And indeed, this guy says that part of his role is safeguarding against the risks of AI. But digging into the guy a bit and reading what he's said to the press about his goals, it's all about advancing Canada's global leadership in AI and spreading AI further across the federal government and, quote, distilling real impact zones. He says that everybody's focus on AI risks can shut out innovation. You get the sense that this guy is much more about pushing AI than regulating it. And beyond what he says, there's like the way he says it. I mean, how exactly does one distill an impact zone? Honestly, there is so much hocus pocus and hype around this technology. For me, it's gotten in the way of getting my head around it. Like everybody, I have played with AI. I have found it to be pretty neat. But, you know, for my purposes, it's a toy that has already lost much of its novelty. Just you wait, I'm told. I'm told that both by the people who love AI and by the people who hate it. Those who love it tell me that AI represents nothing less than a major leap forward in human achievement and human consciousness itself, and it is about to change everything. Meanwhile, those who hate it tell me that AI is an Oppenheimer-level man-made threat to humanity, and it's about to change everything. And nobody has adequately explained to me exactly why it is these things, or even what it is, really. Like, what is artificial intelligence? Could you explain it to an 8-year-old if you had to, or, you know, to me? For starters, what does AI look like? Might sound like a dumb question to ask about a technology that we do not think of as even having a physical existence. But it's actually a question with an answer. And today you're going to hear that answer. Because AI is not post things. It is not something that exists without atoms, without solid objects that we can see and touch. Some of those things are machines, and some of those things are us. Our senior producer, Bruce Thorson, has this one for you. Wait for it.
A few months ago, Mark Zuckerberg's Meta released an ad for one of their new AI systems.
design a training program so that I can run a marathon.
What can I see with a telescope from Cedar Lake?
In it, a rotating cast of shiny, happy people ask their even shinier phones advice on directions, recipes, translation.
Some trivia.
Oh, yes, let's do that.
Yeah. Imagine a treehouse.
In a big oak tree with a porch and a ladder.
Imagine Little Italy in 1954.
Hey, Mira. Look at these.
What really struck me about this ad was the ending.
It starts with an empty prompt that takes you as far as you want to go.
As if that empty prompt is a question mark, just hoping you'll shape its direction. As if the AI you're holding in your hand came from nowhere. Just floating in a cloud somewhere. Like that metaphoric cloud, the AI that desires your prompt floats free and clean above the concerns of the world. But before we go much further, I have a couple introductions I want to make. First, James. James, who are you and what do you do?
My name's James Muldoon. I'm an associate professor in management at the University of Essex and I live in East London. I'm an AI researcher primarily and my work interrogates the nature of AI supply chains. How is AI built and what processes are involved?
And Dolores, a few words about you.
My name is Dolores. I'm an AI narrator, self-described as soothing, adult, feminine. I'll be reading extracts from James's book, Feeding the Machine.
Dolores will dip into James's book now and then to quote things, things like this.
In the public, AI is associated with images of glowing brains, neural networks, and weightless clouds, as if AI itself simply floated through the ether. We tend not to picture the reality of the constant heat and white noise of whirring servers loaded into heavy racks at energy-intensive data centers, nor the tentacle-like undersea cables that carry AI training data across the globe. AI has a material body and exists only through new chips, servers, and cables being manufactured and added to the machine. And just like a physical body, AI's material structure needs constant nourishment through electricity to power its operations and water to cool its servers. Every time we ask ChatGPT a question or use an internet search engine, the machine lives and breathes through this digital infrastructure.
So if you've ever wondered what Siri looks like...
Close your eyes, clear your mind. Well, that's what I look like.
Wow. So Siri can bull. Close your eyes, clear your mind. That's what I look like. What the hell does that mean? According to James Muldoon, Siri does actually have a real body. And it's a sprawling, energy-sucking mass of whirring servers that casts her tentacle-like undersea cables around the globe.
Siri, what's the name of the guy I had a meeting with a couple of months ago at Cafe Grinnell?
You met Zach Wingate at Cafe Grinnell.
Hey!
Zach!
Oh, wow, I didn't think you'd remember me.
Yeah, of course. As soon as I saw you, I'm like, it's Zach. Nobody walks like Zach.
So the woman in the ad pretends to remember the guy's name, but is actually prompted by Siri. And when Siri can't remember a name, Siri is actually prompted by an invisible army of laborers, actual humans, who'll figure it out for the AI. In true Matrix style, Siri's tentacle-like undersea cables are feeding off the knowledge of thousands, tens of thousands of humans. Actually, you can choose your own dystopian adventure here. Keanu Reeves' Matrix or Star Trek's Borg, whatever suits you. Anyway, Dolores has something to say. Actually, Dolores is feeding off the hard work of real human James Muldoon. Cue Dolores.
We also tend to forget that behind the seemingly automated processes of AI often lies the disguised labor of human workers forced to compensate for the limitations of technology. When Siri does not recognize a voice command, or when facial recognition software fails to verify a person's identity, these cases are often sent to human workers to establish what went wrong. And sophisticated software functions only through thousands of hours of low-paid and menial labor. Workers are forced to work like robots in the hopes that AI will become more like a human.
Speaking of humans, I'd like to bring in James Muldoon.
You know, this data has to be prepared and produced, and often this requires a lot of manual labor. I think when we imagine AI and we kind of think about how automated it is, how intelligent it is, most of us would never suspect that behind this technology lay all of this kind of very menial, very tedious human work.
The sensors that the Waymo driver uses are incredibly powerful, using a combination of LiDAR, cameras, and radar, which allows the Waymo driver to visualize the world around it in milliseconds to a high degree of accuracy.
Then, with a strong foundation derived from artificial intelligence, the Waymo driver crunches all that data and calculates a safe route while responding in real time to the evolving traffic environment.
For the AI behind autonomous vehicles to understand the difference between cars, traffic lights, and pedestrians, they need to be fed millions of correctly tagged examples showing the relevant objects in a variety of circumstances. Every frame of the archives used to train these systems has to have the appropriate objects, people, signposts, cats, trees, other cars, labeled with near-perfect accuracy.
For 1 hour of annotated footage, it takes 800 human hours to annotate that footage correctly. That means drawing all those boxes around it, making sure that machines are able to read it, and that the accuracy levels are extraordinarily high, because you wouldn't want a machine to effectively misinterpret an object out on the road. So that's what data annotation is. Huge amounts of human work doing very messy, very fiddly, but also quite short and simple tasks that are required to make AI possible.
This is tedious, mind-numbing work. Basically, if you can imagine a call center, a cubicle farm, where hundreds, thousands of workers are lit by the glow of screens, hour after hour, day after day, month after month, labeling mundane, often minute, video objects. A tree, a cat, a car, a stop sign. And the workers themselves are in a sense automated as well, because they have to process X number of videos per hour, per minute, to keep their jobs. But who is doing this work, and where exactly are they? Numbers are hard to come by, but Muldoon estimates that there's hundreds of thousands of people spread across the globe to make AI happen. For the most part, the work is farmed out to the global south.
How is this undertaken then? What kind of working conditions do people have? You know, along with a whole range of other back-end office work, during the 1990s, all of this work was outsourced to countries predominantly in the global south. You know, many companies sought to find cheaper and more flexible ways of having this work undertaken. And, you know, first and foremost, that meant, you know, call centers in India, various Excel spreadsheet kind of work being done by workers in Kenya, in the Philippines. A lot of these, you know, firstly former British colonies where English language is widely taught and wages are very low. You know, these were the ideal conditions that people were kind of looking for. So when we think about AI and this kind of data annotation work being outsourced, it follows a long line of this work being kind of delivered to different parts of the global economy, places where it was just more profitable and efficient for these companies to do so. But what has actually happened when we visited one of these AI data annotation centers is, you know, the work is done for incredibly low wages. You know, the workers were getting little more than a dollar US an hour. and under really appalling conditions. Workers were on very short-term contracts, so all the workers were terrified that at the end of their contract they would be dismissed and they would no longer have a job. And this was kind of used as a labor management technique to kind of force the workers to work more efficiently.
That's the annotators, the tens of thousands of people laboring in cubicle farms, mostly in the global south, who are making sure you don't notice a bump in your driverless car experience. But there's another group of people training AI data who see far worse things than signposts and pedestrians.
You're not doing anything, you
The other group of largely unseen AI laborers are the content moderators.
Context is everything. It's not simply the words you use, but the sentiment infused in those words that can make the difference between laughter and tears. At GoBubble, we believe that by understanding emotional context, we can help our clients build safer, healthier, and kinder communities. Our solutions use proprietary emotion-based AI models for good, identifying and muting toxic content such as racism, hate speech.
A slightly different form of AI data work called content moderation. And this might be looking at explicit photos on Facebook or other social media platforms and moderating these and finding, you know, trying to detoxify the internet by, you know, essentially trying to tag these and remove these from social media websites. So in addition to the work being very monotonous, very boring, very tedious and done for little pay and for very long hours, you know, sometimes this work could be very distressing as well, because in addition to building these systems in the first place, a lot of these workers had to try to detoxify them as well.
The most disturbing thing was not just the violence, another moderator told us. It was the sexually explicit and disturbing content. Moderators witnessed suicides, torture, and rape almost every day, commented the same moderator. You normalize things that are just not normal. Workers in these moderation centers are continually bombarded with graphic images and videos and given no time to process what they are witnessing. They're expected to action between 500 and 1,000 tickets a day.
These are essentially the janitors of AI, underpaid, largely unseen, but providing a crucial service.
How about generate an image of a cat playing guitar?
Is that how it works? Am I doing AI?
Yeah, it just does whatever you type.
What are last-minute gift ideas you can make with arts and crafts?
Plan a workout routine to get bigger calves.
Help me think of titles for my tell-all memoir.
What's something smart I can say about Renoir?
Generate another image of a cat playing guitar.
If a girl calls me a snack, how do I reply?
Yeah, that's how it works.
Make this email sound more professional before it hits send.
Moving on from the human toll of AI, it's time to consider the environmental costs.
We tend not to picture the reality of the constant heat and white noise of whirring servers loaded into heavy racks at energy-intensive data centers, nor the tentacle-like undersea cables that carry AI training data across the globe.
Yeah, so AI also requires a vast amount of, you know, physical and material infrastructure in order to function, things like data centers, supercomputers, and the environmental impact of AI is something that is, you know, getting more and more attention.
The International Energy Agency estimated that in 2022, data centers and data transmission networks consumed 2 to 3% of the world's energy, the equivalent of the total electricity consumption of France or Germany.
And there's also the water needed to cool these data centers. AI is thirsty.
A large data center can consume between 11 and 19 million liters of water each day, equivalent to an American town of 50,000 people. In Google's 2023 environmental report, it stated it consumed 5.6 billion gallons of water in 2022, which was a 20% increase on the previous year. Bruce,
Yes, Dolores.
Can I point out something?
Sure.
You said just now that AI is thirsty.
Correct.
And that Google alone used 5.6 billion gallons of water in 2022.
Correct.
I don't mean to sound obvious, but you must be aware then that every word you have me say means that I'm sucking up water somewhere.
Thanks, Dolores.
You know, every drop counts after all. It's actually the users of Google, like yourself, who push the buttons to drain that 5.6 billion gallons of water.
Thank you, Dolores.
At the turn of the decade, in kind of 2019, 2020, a lot of these large tech companies promised that they would be going carbon neutral or carbon negative. They were hoping that they could kind of, even potentially in Microsoft's case, take out carbon that had historically been put in by the company, you know, going back to its founding. And what we've seen over the last 3 to 5 years since AI has become such an incredibly big part of their businesses is that, you know, their carbon emissions have actually increased by 30 to 50% for some of these large tech companies, that when it actually came down to it, despite their promises of reducing their amount of carbon they were emitting into the atmosphere, the necessity of building huge amounts of AI infrastructure, of new data centers, of new forms of powering them, you know, actually led to their emissions, you know, really going right up.
The growth of computational needs has given rise to the expansion of data centers and the creation of enormous hyperscale cloud computing providers, sometimes called hyperscalers. These are huge facilities that have the ability to scale large systems of memory, compute, and storage. This uses a lot of energy and places large demands on the local electricity grid, with a hyperscaler using as much power as up to 80,000 American households.
So the more of these that are produced, the larger the electricity and water demand on very stretched systems. So, you know, this is something that is a pressing concern for many communities across the globe.
Coming up, what happens when the tech model morphs from move fast and break things to move fast and steal things? As an extraction machine, we've looked at AI extracting labor. We've measured some of the impacts of resource extraction. Now moving on to the pillaging of our collective human heritage, extraction of culture. Or, as Dolores would like to share from the book,
AI companies are essentially selling what they don't own. The value of image generator tools is based on the human originals, ripped from large data sets and monetized on the sly. These companies have adapted the tech industry's famous motto, move fast and break things, to move fast and steal things, while giving little consideration to the human creators who will be most affected. The image generators allow anyone to knock off an artist's style and threaten their livelihoods without any remuneration or credit for using their work.
In the fast-moving world of generative AI, image generation continues to reach new heights. With the introduction of Imagen 3 on Vertex AI, we are launching our highest quality text-to-image model. Let's say we want to generate a photo of a family on an RV camping trip. Maybe we want to capture them sitting around a campfire making s'mores and admiring fireflies in the night sky.
Shucks, good golly, gee, how sweet. A family on a camping trip, a cozy campfire, s'mores, starlight. What could possibly be wrong with this picture?
We're encouraged to see AI as creating something out of nothing, as just this fantastic, near magical machine that we can simply type in a prompt and it will produce text, poetry, paintings, videos, whatever we want, just through the magic of the algorithms and how the technology works. So it takes 1,000 paintings and it kind of works out the way in which it could kind of reproduce something that will pass for what it has seen in its training data. It's a relationship of extraction, of taking something from what previously perhaps had fallen out of copyright or was part of a kind of broad digital commons or simply belonged to a particular individual. It's taking those kinds of ideas, that kind of material, and it's repackaging it for the purposes of producing a product that will hopefully be profitable for these tech companies. So the main move that's actually happening here is very close to theft, if you get what I mean. It's very close to taking something that is not the tech companies, using a kind of sleight of hand by having these algorithms that can repackage the material, and then producing it as the company's proprietary technology.
I tried to get Dolores to provide me with a poignant, reflective sigh here. Sadly, it seems there's some things only humans can do. Anyway, you can do your own poignant sigh at home if you feel like it at this point in the story. We're dangerously close to being submerged in a dystopian world here.
Some of this does sound a little bit dystopian, but I just think that's where we are. I think we do live in a slightly more dystopian world than we did 5 years ago. Both because all of this is becoming more industrialized and commercialized, and the big tech monopolies and the tech cartels really are becoming larger and more closed. When we had the first generation of tech platforms come out, they were starting them in their garages, right? Mark Zuckerberg was coding Facebook in his Harvard dorm room. Jeff Bezos was soliciting like $50,000 from his friends and family to start Amazon. None of that would be possible today, right? To get in the game, you need to have billions of dollars to compete against the current titans. And all of the startups that we've seen enter this space have by necessity been forced to join themselves with legacy tech companies, right? OpenAI exists in its current form because of its partnership with Microsoft. Amazon's investment in Anthropic is another case in point. All of the big tech companies are controlling and exercise a considerable ownership stake over how AI is developing. So if it sounds dystopian, I think that's because it is, because we haven't seen anything like this before, and it's kind of consolidating everything that kind of went wrong with big tech over the first kind of two decades of what we could call the platformization of society.
The goal here was not to dismiss the possible benefits of AI. AI has already brought about real advancements in medicine, and we're sure to see positive developments across a broad range of fields. But once again, James has a few words of caution about the future, based on what we've seen in the recent past. Back when people thought Facebook was cool, and before Google dropped its motto, "Don't be evil."
Just when Google came out with its search engine, and when Facebook and others came out with this idea of social networks, in the beginning, there was so much hype and so much interest in the technology about all the possibilities that it could contain, about how it would change the world. You know, in some ways it did, but in a lot of other ways, it was just basically a new way to deliver advertising. That's kind of what most people in Facebook and Google work on, ways to maximize user engagement and to deliver them more effective and more profitable ads. That's what the greatest minds of our generation are kind of working on. And I think the sad thing with AI is how much all of the incredibly potentially life-changing and world-changing aspects of the technology will be put in the service of what is profitable. And that's just going to be what big business needs it for. And so I think that is kind of, yeah, the sad thing about how AI, I think, is going to develop over the next decade.
Generate an image of a cat playing guitar.
Is that how it works? Am I doing AI?
Yeah, it just does whatever you type.
What are last-minute gift ideas you can make with arts and crafts?
Plan a workout routine to get bigger calves.
Help me think of titles for my tell-all memoir.
What's something smart I can say about Renoir?
Generate another image of a cat playing guitar.
If a girl calls me a snack, How do I reply?
Yeah, that's how it works. You're doing AI.
That's your Canada Land. Hope you liked it. You can email me about the show at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. You can follow me on Blue Sky where I post stuff. This episode was written and presented by our senior producer, Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione, along with some original music this week from Tristan. Additional help from Caleb Thompson. Max Collins is Canada Land's director of audio. Fact check on this episode by Max Collins. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking about the news. We're going to talk about favors from rich friends scandal in the Trudeau cabinet that's getting a bit overlooked, what with the holy of everything else that's going on. But mostly, we will be talking about what could be the most widely viewed Canadian political interview ever, Jordan Peterson's interview with Pierre Poilievre. We will talk about what the incredible viewership numbers on that video mean for where Canadian media is headed. And I don't know how many of you made it to the end of that long interview, but we will talk about Pierre Poilievre's offer to swap wives with Donald Trump.
I think that's a deal that President Trump would take because it's good for America and it's good for Canada.
Wait for that. Welcome back to the show, teacher and TikToker Frank Dominic.
So much fun stuff to talk about.
Frank, I have been asking the question for months now. Once Pierre Poilievre is prime minister and he goes through with one of his primary promises of defunding the CBC and getting rid of the media subsidies that are paying for a lot of reporters' salaries here, and we lose thousands of reporters and news organizations go under, I've wondered, okay, fine, but where do you expect Canadians to get their information from? Even from his perspective, like, who's he going to talk to?
It's looking great for social media grifters.
I think we know who he's going to talk to.
Hello, everybody. I had the opportunity and the privilege today to speak with Mr. Pierre Poilievre, who is the leader of Canada's Federal Conservative Party, but also, barring catastrophe and God willing, Canada's next prime minister.
So Jordan Peterson sat down with Pierre Poilievre, and as is often the routine now, the legacy media follows whatever you want to call online media. And the takes that I was reading were a lot of like eye-rolly, like, who the hell has time for these two for an hour and a half? I watched it so you don't have to. I should get some danger pay for this one. Feel for me. A lot of this kind of like commiserating tone.
I watched the Jordan Peterson interview with Pierre Poilievre so you don't have to. You guys really owe me for this one.
Well, for my own mental health and well-being, I've had my eyes and ears focused on the World Junior, so I didn't dive deep into Jordan Peterson and Pierre Poilievre.
Everyone really wants the nation to know that they didn't watch it unless they had to. Do you know who did watch it?
You?
Yeah, along with...
a few million people, potentially?
At this point, I think that we're at something like 43 million views, and that's just on Twitter. Then on YouTube, it's sitting at around 3.3 million views. And then there are all these other platforms now, the conservative Twitter wannabes and video platforms. And then there's like, it's being clipped and shared on TikTok. And then you've got Peterson's podcast, which like a ton of people listen to. So you add it all up, but like how many people have seen slash heard at least parts of this interview? Tens of millions of people. This is not something that happens like ever for an interview with a Canadian politician.
So that's the thing, is that those views on Twitter, is it actually 45 million or is it just 45 scrolls past? You know what
I mean? No, it's not, but all social media analytics are bullshit. But as Cory Doctorow says, my bull numbers are higher than your bull numbers, right? So the way that Twitter counts a video view is like, you know, whatever it might be. I don't know if it's 3 seconds or 30 seconds. So, and a lot of the people who you're counting the same person two or three times, but the apples to apples is to compare that to other Canadian politicians being interviewed.
Which don't hit those numbers at all.
I'm not saying they don't hit those numbers at all. I'm saying that they don't come close. It's my job to keep an eye on media consumption, among other things. And the success of this video feels to me like a watershed moment. Like, do not ignore this moment. Chris Sully saying online, I am truly amazed by how many times I've heard and overheard Jordan Peterson's conversation with Pierre Poilievre mentioned at the pub tonight. This pub is in Toronto Center, Liberal stronghold. There's a lot of talk in American media about this inflection point that was reached somewhere in the last 12 months where more people got their information from post-legacy news sources than legacy news sources. That's, you know, the Gladwellian tipping point where this trend has reached the point where it actually matters more. People talked about this a lot with, like, why Kamala should have gone on Rogan.
You right, know? Go to where the people are.
Go to where the people are versus the tactic that I think is a failed tactic of describing that entire conversation, that entire discourse as deplorable. And the mistake that Hillary Clinton made in saying that's a basket of deplorables. The mistake that Mark Miller, Liberal MP Mark Miller, just made. What does he say about this Peterson-Poilievre interview? Not the biggest surprise in the world to see these two greasy walruses promote each other's ego. Is this where we're headed? I have two things to say about that. First of all, bravo, greasy walruses.
Honestly, it is a funny trick.
That's funny.
It's hilarious.
I don't even know. Are walruses greasy? I like the wordplay there. Greasy walruses.
It's a really good evocative imagery.
And then you look at the image of Peterson and Poilievre, and they just don't look like wholesome. Like, yeah, they are greasy walruses. Okay, fine.
Pierre looks exhausted in that interview, by the way. Like, he looks like he doesn't really want to be talking to Peterson.
And so, yeah. Like...
They get the party, I get the hangover.
Oh, you yeah. definitely are going to get the hangover.
It's true. I would say he does an incredibly good job in that interview. But parking that for a second, Mark Miller getting that line in about them being greasy walruses is the stupidest thing that any Liberal MP could be doing at this point. Because when Hillary Clinton called all of the people deplorables, she is speaking to her crowd who want to feel virtuous and like we're not like those scumbags.
But the out crowd is bigger than the in crowd.
And there's no coming back from that. When you've been called a deplorable, like, okay, you think I'm subhuman. You think I'm dirt. I guess I am on this other side now. It's hilarious to me to see these Canadian media figures, whether they are legacy media figures or people who are like making TikTok careers for themselves, who much like me are playing to audiences that are a fraction of the size that Jordan Peterson commands. I am not a fan of Jordan Peterson. We have done a lot of investigations that have revealed things about Jordan Peterson. I've done a lot of criticism of the things Jordan Peterson has said. I've written critically about him in the New York Times. We have to live in a reality-based world. Jordan Peterson is a major figure. And the fact that this like 90 minutes of conversation plus like paywalled content like for the Daily Wire.
I'm going to talk to Mr. Poilievre for another half an hour on the Daily Wire side.
Is getting numbers like that. Like, I know that those aren't real numbers, but that number is larger than the population of Canada itself. There's an order of magnitude difference in the new normal. There's no corollary on the left or even the center. And you can say to this question of accountability that I bring up at the beginning of like, who is Pierre Poilievre think he's going to answer to? What is the media? And you could go after him and say like, this guy doesn't like, we've asked for an interview, he's never gotten one. But the Liberals have no higher ground there morally because the only interview that Canadians heard with Trudeau
was 22 minutes, right?
Happy New Year, Prime Minister.
Happy New Year, Mark.
You're wearing your Swiftie bracelet.
I still have it.
How old are you? Well, you had to remember, you know, you can't really dance like no one is watching. You have to dance like someone is filming you on your phone.
Well, that's just the era we're in right now.
Well, if anybody needs to shake it off.
Okay, there you go. See, I know that. Now I'm going to go.
That's it. He canceled all of his year ends, and it was taped before the break. In this moment of national crisis, what did Canadians hear from Trudeau? He went to his friendly just as... Poilievre went to his friendly. And the only difference is that nobody gives a, and the audience size is very, very different.
So one thing I think that we should be looking at is that it's only right now, after this election in the U.S., that Democrats and people on the center and the left in the U.S. are looking at mobilizing media in a way that will move things away from mainstream media TV to more influencer or personality-based focus like the Republicans and conservatives have in the U.S. since the days of Rush Limbaugh radio, right? So this is something that the right has been working on in the U.S. for decades. And the Democrats are only just now picking up on it, just like how the conservatives in Canada are only just now picking up on it. The benefit the conservatives and right-wing influencers have in Canada is that they can piggyback off of the audiences of people like Jordan Peterson and Elon Musk, Joe Rogan, and other creators who give more credence to people on the right. Even if like they're not inherently right-wing or Republican-type people, you're still going to get more of a boost from that. And what I think people on the left and on the center in Canada need to start doing is finding their own ways to mobilize, create their own media. So, for example, there's a few creators like Rachel Gilmore. I see Steve Boots on YouTube and on Twitter and some other platforms. Creators who are creating content, Canadian content. We are also filling our own niches and voids.
Americans have been trying for a long time to replicate. I mean, this goes back to, I remember Air America, when they tried to combat against Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and American right-wing media by having a left-leaning talk radio network with people like Chuck D and Mark Maron talking left-wing stuff.
The only benefit of doing the morning show was like no one gave a f-. You know, like all they cared about was Franken and, you know, a couple of other shows. But we were getting there. No one was in the office. We were doing shit on the air that was crazy.
It just didn't work. It was an audience failure. No matter how big the right-leaning media gets, it still plays an underdog role. And it gets a lot of its fuel and a lot of its satire and a lot of its juice out of being like, we're here, independent and fierce, taking on the establishment.
You know, the liberal media is all saying, well, surely you wouldn't want to trigger an election during the liberal leadership race. Excuse me.
We're saying what the establishment won't say, even though we have larger audiences than the establishment.
That's right. They can still play David even when they're the Goliath. So now you're seeing that flipped around and you're seeing like, what's the biggest TikTok from the Canadian creators that you're mentioning? The ones where they criticize the Jordan Peterson video. So they're still using Peterson's brand and fame. And, you know, I'm not throwing stones because we'll put his name in this episode's title as well, because people want to hear about Jordan Peterson from a critical point of view.
Because you got to go where the people are, and that's what the people are talking
about. Well, definitely we want audience, but we also want to criticize the media, and increasingly things like this are the media. What am I going to talk about, the National or that Peterson video? So I think it is becoming increasingly my job and the job of anybody who's a media watchdog or critic. Look at videos by Jordan Peterson. This is where Canadian eyeballs are at. And if this is what is standing in for holding politicians accountable, I have questions. Let's hear some of the tough questions that Jordan Peterson asked of Pierre Poilievre.
What do you think you guys are doing right? Why should Canadians believe that the vision that you just laid out is something that you hold personally dear? Tell us what you've learned. What did we do wrong as a country? Who are the people you have in positions to implement your plan? And I'd like to know what you think their strengths are. Let's close with this. How are you a different person than you were 2.5 years ago?
My toddler asks harder hitting questions when she wants to know what's for dinner.
It was really shameful. But what do you expect? The guy doesn't even pretend to be doing a journalistic interview. The interview is
philosophical.
Like, it's like presented to Canadians as meet your next prime minister. Like, it's essentially, here's an endorsement. In what way is this distinguished from just an advertisement for Poilievre? I suppose because no money changed hands. You can't say that anybody else has the higher moral ground over Poilievre, because Trudeau went on a series of podcasts. It wasn't just Mark Critch. He won't come on anything critical. He canceled all of his interviews. He won't come on our politics show. Jagmeet is doing the TikTok rounds. I expect politicians to go for the maximum exposure for the lowest amount of accountability. And the only thing that's ever made politicians sit down for a grilling is a transaction where, in order to get the exposure, you have to face the accountability. And that machine is broken.
It sucks that my generation and everyone who's going to come after that has to now deal with the fallout of that, because we don't remember an era where people were accountable to media.
The question for me, and I think for journalists, is how can we make ourselves matter? How can we make ourselves like, you have to come here. You have to face me. You have to answer these questions. Do the people want a interview like that? Do they want to see 2 hours of these greasy walruses? rhetorically flating each other.
Also, I, on behalf of all Canadians, want to thank you for your immense courage and the personal, political, and non-political price that you have paid for standing up for your convictions and defending freedom of speech, because I know you have paid a very big price for that.
Thank you, sir. It's been a privilege, far more than a price.
It's more interesting and informative to watch a tough interview. So the puzzle I'm trying to solve is, how do we build audiences that expect that, that want that, and that make us popular enough that politicians have to subject themselves to that?
It's rough because whether it's Survivor, Desperate Housewives, Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, people like being part of what is popular. And we're at this tipping point where what is popular? It's Rogan. I don't like listening to Rogan, but I will have to inevitably go and listen to some clips of a Rogan interview if I want to be part of the online discourse. And that is just where we are at.
I have respect for people like Rogan the same way I had respect for Rush Limbaugh or Howard Stern. They are good broadcasters. Rogan is curious about his guests and he asks questions. I don't think he's terribly informed. I don't think he has any sense of journalistic responsibility, but I think that he maintains a conversational space where he wants to ask questions of people he finds interesting, and it's a very warm and inviting place. We've got to lose this snootiness about this. Like I think that people want to listen to good conversations. People got tired of the elitism of journalists always presenting themselves as the people who know better than you.
And that's why gatekeeping. And I think that's, as much as I hate that term, it's a legitimate concern, I think, from the average person.
After the break, we will dare to duck behind the Jordan Peterson paywall to report on an additional 30 minutes of hot, greasy walrus action. Wait for that. If they're going to run 90 minutes of Peterson and Polyev, what didn't they run? Well, it was for subscribers only. So God help us, we paid for a temporary Daily Wire subscription. Here's a little peek at what was too hot, or I don't know, just I think not of interest to the wider audience. It actually was interesting what they saved. And this has to do with what the biggest question in Canada is right now. What, as we talk about what's the future of the Liberal Party and what's Trudeau's legacy, what's not getting talked about is what is our plan for dealing with Trump? Especially as Trump's rhetoric around the 51st state continues to heat up and we hear about this economic force that he intends to use against Canada. So what will Polyev's approach be when he's negotiating with Trump? And Polyev and Peterson got into that.
What I would say to President Trump is that the gains that Canada gets from increased access to the United States, I would spend largely on our continental defense. Let's take out a map of our shared continent. Where do you believe we need to do more to protect our shared security across that map?
Mm-hmm. That would include the securing of the northern border.
Of course, the northern border and then the Arctic. Then let's come up with a plan to do that, and we'll do our part.
Okay, so you'd start with border security and military issues, perhaps.
Yes. Well, I think that's because I think that's what they're really concerned about. So it goes from zero sum to a positive for both countries. I think that's a deal that President Trump would take because it's good for America and it's good for Canada. So it's the deal that I would push.
We just saved you a subscription to the Daily Wire there, listeners. There's Pierre Poilievre saying that he would take out a map of Canada and ask Trump, where should we build up our military?
Can I tell you why that's genius? Here's the thing.
Evening,
I don't like a lot of what Pierre has to say, but the guy understands people in politics. Trump would love to point at a map and say, put more military here. That goes right into the type of behaviors we've seen with him with hurricanes and him drawing new lines on maps. That is politically, I think, while it sounds silly, a great strategic move if he was to physically actually do that. I just don't think that the other things that he was talking about in terms of pushback to Trump and the American government are going to be successful.
Yeah, I mean, if abdicating our sovereignty and our own, self-determination over our national defense
to a
psychotic American president, if we can kind of put aside those concerns, yes, it plays well to Trump's ego to turn this into a risk game where Trump wins. Where would you like us to put our helicopters, sir? It's true. That is good psychological manipulation that would probably be effective of Trump.
And he frames it in a way where it's we're doing this because we're allies, but where we're really going to fight them back is at natural resources. We're going to build up our natural resources.
I'll be very blunt. I intend to approve refineries and LNG plants and hopefully pipelines so that I can bring that production back to Canada and make us more energy independent.
As if there's not the infrastructure that is currently being worked on, he's making it sound like he's going to snap his fingers and overnight we're going to magically have the stuff that we need to not send our natural resources to the U.S. to be refined.
Look, we're having a conversation about the practical realities of things in a world that has become pretty absurd. And to have a reality-based conversation like this is to discuss these absurd characters talking about absurd things. But I don't know what alternative we have. The only alternative, I think, is to live in the world that you wish it was or to pretend that these things aren't real. What am I talking about here? Here is a member of parliament from Mississauga, Iqra Khalid, pretending that this just isn't real. Did Russia fund this Pierre Poilievre interview? She asks. Okay, and I guess this is substantiated by Trudeau himself, who during the inquiry into foreign interference said without any substantiation that Peterson is funded by Russia. Of course, Peterson denied this allegation from Trudeau. Is it true? Maybe it is. I don't. Or does that mean that Russia like funded some like, you know, Google placement of Peterson content? I have no idea because we have a prime minister who's doing red smear stuff without substantiating it. How many years did Americans waste pretending that Trump wasn't real? He was just a Russian invention.
It's been about a decade now.
Here we are going down the American road again. Did Russia fund this recent Pierre Poilievre interview? I guess we'll never know because he refuses to get his security clearance. Peter Julian of the NDP. This is saying definitively, this is part of a massive foreign interference strategy, which is the only reason Pierre Poilievre is leader of the Conservative Party right now. Peter Julian saying that not with reference to the Peterson interview, but with reference to this Luc Lebrun dialogue that's coming up. So Luc Lebrun, who is a journalist for Press Progress, which is funded by the Broadbent Institute, which is an NDP-affiliated think tank, he was banned from the R Canada subreddit after a piece of his was shared on there. All of these people on the journalistic left are investigating, like, is Reddit controlled by Russia? Is R Canada controlled by Russia? Is the entire conservative ascendance in Canada controlled by Russia? And I have huge problems with this, not because there isn't some Russian interference in our discourse. We know that there is. But A, because it's created this atmosphere of like smearing people as red, as Russian agents. It's not just Peterson who gets smeared. David Pugliese gets this because nothing has to actually be substantiated. You could just point a finger at anybody.
I think one of the things that people are doing now is they're misconstruing domestic Canadian right-wing issues, not issues in terms of like political discourse, but issues in terms of like legitimate fundamental issues with like the far right in Canada with Russian interference. So for example, anybody who's been on Reddit knows that for at least the last five, if not longer years, the R Canada subreddit has been controlled by Nazi adjacent style moderators. And that is a legitimate thing. That has nothing to do with Russia.
No, we reported on this years ago. I think Style is doing a lot of work there. But yeah, the people, it is of concern that the biggest, you know, like who cares about Reddit? Well, 3 million Canadians are subscribed to R Canada. It's the default subreddit for Canada. And it's where a lot of people go to get their Canadian news. And the moderators are anonymous people who have like weird alt-right
connections, yeah.
Conspiratorial connections. Ooh, scary. I go to R Canada and what do I see? A bunch of links to mainstream news stories. I am not afraid of R Canada. I think it sucks that they're not transparent and they banned Luc Lebrun.
And there is some curation that prevents certain types of dialogue from occurring. But at the end of the day, like conflating that with Russian interference.
Let's know as much about that as possible. Let's hats off to any journalist who's trying to get us behind the scenes of the Redditors at R Canada. Fine. But yeah, that is not.
It's not interference.
It's not a Russian op. The reality is people are voting for Poilievre because they want him to be prime minister, not because the Russians convinced them to.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about foreign interference, I think the thing that Canadians should be more concerned about is not Russia, but Elon Musk, mainly because he has already shown that he is more than willing to interfere in multiple countries' electoral situations. If you look at not just the US, but the UK, Germany, other countries in Europe he's actually started to make comments about. And now with Canada, I'm not concerned that he retweeted Peterson's video. Like, that's his prerogative. What I am concerned about is that he tries to start meddling in conservative politics in Canada. I don't think Pierre wants that at all. I don't think Pierre is going to give in to Elon the same way that we have seen it occur in other places. But I am concerned that he is going to try to force his way into the Canadian conservative sphere. And I believe that to have a healthy democracy, we need fundamentally strong, conservative, liberal, progressive, all types of values. I don't think that Elon Musk has a place in dictating those types of values. So when we talk about foreign interference, I'm not concerned about Russia at this moment. I'm concerned about, I don't even know, is Elon American, Canadian, South African? Like, what do we label him?
I think that whatever people listen to or watch, they just need to ask, like, if you were to ask Peterson, like, do you consider yourself a journalist? Is this fact check? Is it your job to hold Polyev accountable? I mean, even he would say, no, it's not.
He would say he's a truth teller, but he wouldn't say that he is a journalist.
Absolutely not. And I think that we have to figure out some way to reintroduce ourselves to the public, rather than just like beating people over the head with our virtue and saying like, you need us, we keep democracy alive. We actually need to illustrate the contrast and the value of the work that we do, so that we scale to the point where it becomes a necessary node. You should have to pass through the scrutiny of somebody who follows basic journalistic principles and whose role, it's not even so much about like, we're better at this than everybody else. It's like, what is your role? You know, Peterson's role, like in his brain, is some, you know, mythic hero. If your role is to represent people's right to know, people's right to have their leaders held to account, this is what I mean when I say just I don't care if it's somebody doing it out of their bedroom or out of a newsroom. If the person speaking to the politician thinks that that's their job, those are the people who need to somehow make their case to the public and hopefully have audiences that somehow come close to the size of these like astonishing figures. I thought Peterson would be done by now. Like I don't find him a very compelling interviewer or speaker.
Most people I know who are conservatives in Canada are mostly done with Peterson, because even when they found things in what he said that was valuable, it's the stuff that he says that's kind of like unhinged that pushes them away from him.
Polyev was so smart in that interview because he let Peterson
say all the crazy.
He went like, he just sit back and Peterson just like waiting for opportunities to just go off.
Well, there's been a real conservative swing, especially among young men. Well, no wonder, because they've been demonized for what, 30 straight years, for every aspect of their masculinity, from their play preferences to their proclivity to destroy the planet with their ambition.
The parts of the interview that Pierre was the weakest on were the parts when he would start saying like, oh, the wokest and the socialists.
And they changed their name to woke, and now they claim they don't want to be called woke anymore. Mm-hmm. The socialists always try to disown the things they've done because it's manifestly disastrous.
We basically, what would you say, imported and invented racism in Canada. Right. As a consequence of policy.
Wokeism seeks to divide people into these different groups and subgroups, and we see the results in a 250% increase in hate crimes.
When he starts getting into that kind of stuff, even people who I know who are dyed-in-the-wool conservatives are like, okay, can we stop talking about this?
Culture war stuff.
Yeah, and using specific slang and targeted terminology. Once we can move away from that, I think that especially a guy like Pierre might actually have a really strong opportunity to convince more Canadians that he is not the boogeyman that people make him out to be, including myself.
I think he overall succeeded in that in this interview, and I think that his big brand shift is going to be moving away from being this little weaselly prick who just, you know, kicks Trudeau in the shins and says the word woke 100 times to being somebody who you could conceive of as a statesman.
Less of a troll and more of a thoughts person. Like, I don't know.
Overall, he did appear that way more than he didn't in that interview, which is a sharp contrast with a very ill-advised anti-wacko video that the Conservatives put out, which was just like...
A little much.
There's probably nothing to fear from most wackos. They often serve as an odd form of entertainment. But what happens if they get into positions of power? What happens if they run a government? Let's start with their leader, Justin Trudeau. He invented a new economic doctrine, wackonomics. The first rule of wackonomics: no math allowed.
The economy is not numbers.
With these people in power, anything is possible. And so the saga continues with a wacko government that mirrors the eccentricities of its leader as Trudeau attempts to hold on to power. The most outrageous moment for these wackos may still be on the horizon.
I think it was them playing to their silliest, most juvenile. It's almost like they let the interns write one or something. And it's so funny because they got like some British guy to narrate the thing, which I think is like, this is going to seem really dumb. How can we make this seem like satire and not just like schoolyard taunts? Get a British narrator.
The Conservatives right now, especially Pierre, are good at trolling. fundamentally subverting expectations and putting people in a position where they can't either defend their own position or they can't accurately attack yours without coming off as sounding like the crazy person. Pierre is so good at that.
Yeah, it's an easier thing to do in opposition than in government. That's our show. Thanks for joining me. You can email me about today's show at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. I'm posting things on Blue Sky. You can find me there. Frank, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter, Blue Sky, TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, all the things.
This episode's produced by James Nicholson, mixing and mastering by Caleb Thompson. Our director of audio is Max Collins, who also did the fact check on this episode. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.